Thank you, Frank. My name's Clayton Vanvert. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. My sobriety date is December the 20th, 1987, and I'm a member of the Sikeson Serenity Group in Sikeson, Missouri, and I have a sponsor, and I sponsor people. I really appreciate being here and just knowing that this place exists makes me happy. And knowing that this place exists makes me proud of AA and proud of what we are to one another. I am just amazed. And I am constantly amazed by AA, and I am constantly amazed that we have these connections with one another and that we share this love for each other. And I'm really happy to be here I'm so grateful to have come and been a part of this. Thank you very much. Laura and I have managed to suck the marrow out of Mont Eagle. I might have the last word, but I don't think I probably ought to have it. I've learned a few things in three marriages. And one of the things that I've learned is there's times to talk and times to be quiet. And everything she said in her talk is literally the truth. And there will be no corrections made from anything tonight. I really enjoyed what Vince had to say. You will hear in my story that I got 12-stepped into Alcoholics Anonymous by a woman working in Al-Anon program, one of my ex-wives. And you'll also hear that, you may not hear this, I don't know, but the woman that's primarily responsible for Laura and I still being married is her Al-Anon sponsor, who's an Al-Anon past delegate named Loretta R., and who is a wonderful woman, and so I owe a great deal of gratitude to Al-Anon, and in fact, some people have suggested that I might, among them, Laura, have suggested that I might benefit from partaking of a little Al-Anon, I've said, hanging out with chicks and being better to myself is change I can believe in. But they've reminded me that that's not quite the kind of Al-Anon that they had in mind for me, that I had some control issues that probably ought to be addressed. But I really do love Al-Anon. I like to hear Al-Anon speakers, and I thought Vince was one of the best ones that I've heard. And I thank you very much. And as you hear my talk, you will find that we have much more in common than you thought. I grew up in the town that I live in now, which is a small combination southern and midwestern town. I was came from a normal family. My dad was a raging Al-Anon. My mother was a kind of a meek alcoholic who just basically drank, and that's pretty much it. She was a very neurotic woman, and I loved her very much. I was a fat kid, and I didn't really fit in. I grew up in the 50s. I didn't play football. I was kind of bookish. I was really a good student. I wore thick horn-rimmed glasses, and I had a burr cut. And I really was not anything to write home about. My daughter Amanda one time saw my high school yearbook, and, she looked at it and she said, "Dad, you really were a nerd." And she was right. About all I did was go to school, and I played a lot of golf. That was my recreation, and that was a sport that I played. And I got to be, pretty good at it. And I made good grades. And I graduated, went to college, and I went to a small college, and fraternities were very big at this college. It's a college called Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. It's a great, great school. But almost the whole social life centered around fraternities, and I joined one. And up until that point, I had never drank anything. I just didn't drink. I was a good kid. I didn't give my parents any problems, and the people that I ran around with, none of us drank. I don't know how that happened. It just happened that way. And when I got to college, of course, that wasn't the case, especially in our fraternity. And I went on this freshman walkout to St. Louis with all these newly pledged fraternity brothers. And we went down to a place that no longer exists in St. Louis called Gaslight Square, which was a kind of a bunch of bars, and we went to this house of ill repute. And to make a long story short, I had my first drink and had sex for the first time in the same evening. And it was a spiritual awakening. And I don't know, it's really hard to say which one I enjoyed more and which one gave me more trouble. You know, I mean, it's kind of tough, as you'll see through the rest of this story. I mean, it's a difficult question. And after I had that first drink, I pretty much set my drinking pattern for the rest of my drinking existence. I was a daily drinker. And I almost immediately started drinking as a daily drinker. And I was pretty much a 5 o'clock drinker. You know, about every afternoon, about 5 o'clock, I'd drink. And I'd drink until I got enough. Now, I don't know what that was, and it varied. You know, if it was Saturday and Sunday, it was a different amount than it would be during the week. And if I had to take a test the next day, I might control it for a little while. And that lasted for a long time. And as you know, it got later in life, it got to be less and less control. But through the early years of my life, I had some degree or some illusion of control about that. And I would pretty much drink moderately during the week and then kind of blow it out on the weekends. And then I found a girl who was in a sorority, and she was from Chicago, and her parents, her dad was a lawyer, and her main attraction, I think, was that her parents drank like I wanted to. Her dad, you know, had a cocktail every day at lunch, and was a kind of a big time lawyer and realtor, and I thought that was pretty neat. And so we got married, and I went to law school. And when I look back on this, when I got into AA and they tried to explain the disease concept and the concept of craving to me, it didn't take a lot of convincing, because I started to think about when I was in law school. And when I was in law school, my typical day would start about 7 o'clock or in the morning. And I would get up and go to school, and I'd go to classes, and then I'd come home. And about 5 o'clock, I would, you know, I'd study in the afternoon, and then about 5 o'clock, I'd eat dinner, and then I'd study until midnight or so. And then every night about that time, I would take a break, and I had a double old-fashioned glass. And I would put ice in it, and I would pour it full of vodka, and I would drink it. And then I would put ice in it again, and I'd pour it full of vodka, and I'd drink it. And I did that every night. And if you ask me why I would do that, I would have no explanation. I would have probably said it was to relax, or it was a nightcap. I now know that what I was doing was holding the craving at bay, holding the physical part of me that craved alcohol, kind of a moderate degree of satisfaction, maybe. But there was certainly no illusion of social drinking about that. But I knew that that I had something, when I look back on it, there was something different about me that required a certain intake of alcohol on a daily basis in order for me to function. I graduated from law school and I took a job in St. Louis with a law firm. It's really funny, it was really the only job I'd ever had up until that point. And they kind of were strange. They wanted to tell me to do things. And I'd never had that before. And they didn't think I was the smartest person who ever lived. And gosh, I couldn't take that. And so I quit there and went back home to my hometown and went to work for a law firm and then became kind of a young man about town, and I became an animal. I became a lion, and I became an elk, and I became an eagle, and I became a JC, and I became any other kind of animal that would get me out of house at night and allow me to go to some bar and drink and hang out with my high school buddies. And by that time, they had all grown up and gotten married and had kids, and we were all looking for some way to get out of the house. And all of those service clubs provided us an avenue to do that. And while the rest of the world at about 30 was settling down and, you know, trying to raise a family and looking towards domestic bliss, we were out, you know, trying to have a second childhood. And we were running these bars and trying to pick up women, and we were wearing cowboy hats and driving pickups and generally doing everything we could to screw up our marriages. And in my case, I did a pretty good job of it. About that time in my life, I went through kind of a physical change. I had been a fat kid up until that time, and I wore thick glasses. And I lost 50 pounds, and I got contacts. And I really thought I was something. And I'd start prowling these bars, and I had a little money. I'd start to be a fairly successful lawyer. And that poor wife at home just didn't understand me. I mean, I had these two kids, a boy named Bill and a girl named Amanda, and all they were an irritant. You know, they just stood in the way of me getting to do what I wanted to do. And the best idea I had was to take up with the girl next door. And of course, she was married too. And everything kind of started to go badly. I started getting real depressed about that time. Of course, that was probably aided and abetted by the fact that I was drinking minimum of 6-pack of beer and, you know, 3 or 4 shots of God knows what and whatever else I wasn't keeping track of on a daily basis, and prowling around in every bar in town and, you know, coming in at 3 o'clock in the morning and trying to work and do whatever else I pleased. I first started about that time. I was about 30, 32. I first started seeing a psychiatrist, and at the suggestion of my mistress, actually. She said, you're pretty depressed. You need to go see somebody. And I thought, well, okay. You know, I'm sure I am. I will. And so I went to see this guy, and I remember us talking about alcoholics. And I told him, I said, you know, I've discovered a new way to try and control my drinking is I'll only drink a beer an hour. And he said, that's a method that alcoholics frequently use to control their drinking. And I said, shit, I better not do that. They'll think I'm an alcoholic. And things started to go really bad. I mean, this relationship with this gal across the street got to be, you know, the topic of everybody's dinner conversation, and the marriage blew up, and I got divorced, and I mean, it just got ugly. And I went from being fairly well respected in town to being, you know, the topic of people's approbation and not very well thought of, and God knows what. Was seeing the shrink more often. He said, "You need a hobby." He said, "Your problem is, you know, you play golf in the summer, but in the winter you really don't have anything. You just got divorced. You got this apartment. All you're doing is sitting around there brooding and drinking, and you need to get a hobby." He said, "Something that'll distract you from all this misery." And I said, "Sounds reasonable." So I got in the newspaper, and I was looking, and they had a section on adult education, and had oil painting. I thought, I probably got an artistic soul. You know, that's probably what I'd be good at. And so I took up oil painting, and it'd be more accurate to say, actually, that I took up with the oil painting instructor. And that was my second wife. And that marriage, she drank like I did. And she wasn't anywhere near as passive as my first wife. And she was the kind of person that if you came in drunk, she's just as likely to throw a plate of red beans and rice at you. I mean, it got to be pretty grim. I mean, we started throwing things at each other, and we started throwing words, and we started throwing punches, and we started throwing a lot of things. And things started going bad for me. I went in the mental hospital and spent 17 days trying to, I mean, it was awful. And that was the first time that people, I mean, these mental health people and wives had suggested that my drinking might have something to do with these problems. That the problems in my life might be connected to alcohol. And that maybe if I did something about my drinking, that some of these problems might get solved. Their solution that they first suggested was a chemical called Anabuse, which, you being a bunch of old-timers and laughing, know what I'm talking about. It's a and for those of you who don't, it's a chemical that you ingest, and you take a pill every day, and if you keep taking those pills and you drink, and you just get sick as a damn dog and wish you were dead, and so you do it once and you'll never do it again, and sometimes they even talk about it, you won't do it again. Well, with me, it was either successful or unsuccessful, or both, depending on how you looked at it. If you looked at it from a physician's standpoint, it was a very successful treatment because I didn't drink. If you looked at it from a sane person's viewpoint, it was awful because I was terrible. I thought I was doing the world a favor. I was angry. I was resentful. I was hard on myself. I was hard on everybody around me. I thought my rights had been trampled on. I thought that I was doing the world a favor that it did not appreciate and did not value. And I was generally a pain in the ass. And I was, in the words of one author, restless, irritable, and discontent to the max. So in that sense, those loving people who had suggested that this might be a valuable therapy suggested that I might consider going back to drinking. You know, that probably wasn't, they might have overestimated the problem. So I kind of tried that for a couple of different times, 6 months at a time, you know, a couple of different times, and it didn't work. One of the times I tried it, they told me, they said, this chemical has a residual effect. It'll stay in your body for 10 days after you stop actively ingesting it. So you cannot drink for 10 days after you stop taking the pills. I said, okay, I can do that. You don't have to worry. I'm not going to drink again anyway. It won't matter. I'm not even going to keep track. But of course, you knew that wasn't true. So on the 10th day, I'm laying in my basement with a bottle of scotch in my hand, dead drunk, and I can't even crawl to the upper floor of my house. And so that was that experiment. One time I tried, you know, this was in the 80s, and we were all trying all these self-help books. You know, we tried, I'm okay, you're okay. And one of the therapies I tried was rational emotive therapy, which is, you know, I'm in charge of my feelings, and, you know, nobody has the capacity to make me mad but me, and all that. That was a complete failure. I drank right through that. One of these people suggested that what I really did was I needed to try self-hypnosis, because since I was under all this pressure and couldn't relax, that's why I drank. So if I could just find a method to relax completely, I wouldn't have to drink quite so much. And so the way that I could do that is do self-hypnosis, which I would put myself in a trance and completely relax myself. Well, I got pretty good at it, and I could really relax without the aid of alcohol, but then I'd be the most relaxed drunk in Scott County, Missouri. You know, I mean, it had no effect on my alcohol consumption at all. One of the things that we tried at my wife's insistence was fundamentalist religion. And she decided that, I won't say fundamentalist, that's probably a bad label. I don't really know enough about it. But she decided we ought to try the Church of Christ. And so I said, okay, I'm willing to try that. So we dutifully started going. And we went for about 6 or 8 weeks. And everything was under pretty good control until the preacher got up and started preaching a sermon on wives obeying their husbands. And then we didn't have to go anymore. So that's kind of the methods that many of us have tried. Those were the methods that I tried and that were tried as with me as the experiment to try and solve this alcohol problem that I had. And as I got older, this alcohol problem started to change, and my drinking started to change. My lovely wife last night said that she didn't know where she had heard the word brownout before, but she couldn't remember where it came from. Well, I guess she's heard me talk too many times. But I used to have brownouts. And my first wife was like a court reporter. She'd sit at the side of the bed, and I'd be laying there like this, and she'd say, "And then you said, and then you did," but she said, "And then you did," and when she did that, it all kind of come back. But as I got older and as my drinking progressed, I'd have complete blackouts. And what that would do is, there's nobody home. I mean, you could have run the video and there'd be nothing upstairs. I mean, it just nothing. And I also started having things happen. One of the things that happened is people started taking my keys away from me, even the people I was drinking with. I mean, ooh, that's pretty bad. I know one time I went to St. Louis with some clients on a deal, and it was a public securities offering, and it was a big deal for all of us, and I borrowed my mother's Cadillac. She had this big old boat Cadillac, and we all drove up there and thought we were hot stuff. And after we made this deal and the company went public and they all made a fortune, we all went out and celebrated, and we just all got rip-roaring drunk. And they took my keys away from me. And I got out there and woke up the next morning and opened those drapes, looked out that hotel room, and that old car was jackknifed across two handicapped parking spaces. And oh my God. I went down to the lobby and this guy is standing there, and he's the guy that took the keys away from me. He says, "I've got good news, bad news, and good news." And I said, "Okay. What is it?" He says, "The good news is we made it home last night." I said, "Yeah, pretty good news. The bad news is my car has one of these push-button locks, and what I generally do is take the keys out of the ignition, throw them in the floor, get out, hit the lock, and close the door. And that's what I did last night." I said, "Oh my God, we got to get a locksmith." He says, "Well," he says, "the good news is all the windows were down." And that's kind of the way it was going. I kept getting these hangovers that used to. I'd get up in the morning and drink a little coffee or eat some greasy food or drink some Coca-Colas or something, and it'd kind of help a little. Now these things were going on for like days, and I wasn't having any sundown recovery, and I wasn't, I was like drinking to get over them, and it was just getting awful. By that time, I'd just worn the second wife out, and she'd taken off to Florida. She was an artist, and she took off to Florida to work shows down there and be with her parents. And anyway, so we got divorced again. So she comes back to get her furniture out of her house, out of our house, my house at that point. And she shows up with a big old rental van and some big old strapping sculptor to help her carry it, of course. And, she comes in there and sits down at the table she's about to haul out. And she says, "I have an amends to make to you." And I said, "Well, now that's not a, I thought, that's not a word that you're used to hearing very often." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, I've joined an organization for the friends and relatives of alcoholics. And we have a program of recovery, and part of it is that we try to atone for the harm that we've done to others." And I'm thinking, friends and relatives of alcoholics. Her daddy must have started really drinking bad again. I said, well, who is your admission ticket to this deal? She said, "You." I said, "You're the alcoholic." I said, "I really am not, because, every time I've tried to stop drinking, it hadn't worked. I mean, these alcoholics, they stop drinking, things get better. I'm not an alcoholic because I can't drink. I mean, when I don't drink, it is worse." She said, "Well, I'm not sure you're right about that. Maybe you ought to try some AA meetings." And so, anyway, she packed up her stuff and went back to Florida. And I knew one person in AA, and it was a lawyer that I'd actually sued. And I saw him in court, and he had this little coin and said, "I got this for being sober a year." I said, "You simpleton." And so I did know him, and he really didn't hold any grudges. And I called him, and he took me to my first AA meeting. And I found out at my first AA meeting that my experience was not that different than the experience of many people who were alcoholics, that when you took the booze away from them, things got worse, and that I had a very strong sense of identification with the people that were in that meeting. I mean, I don't know what it was, and I really couldn't tell you, and I don't know what it is tonight, and I don't know what it has been this weekend or anything else, but there's something there. You know, I mean, I don't know. I'm not smart enough to know. You know, maybe it's hormones or something. I don't have a clue. But there is something that we do or something that we are that we communicate to one another, that we're all in the same tribe or we're all in the same group. And I did think that I was in the proper place. There's a guy that I went to school with that I'd known all my life. And we kind of he referred to me some robbers to represent. And the first thing they'd done is burglarize my office. So we were not on the greatest of terms, but I'd drive by his house and I'd see his old beat up car there, but I lost touch with him and I wondered what he was doing. I knew he was up to no good because I'd never seen. And I knew he lived with his mother, and I just didn't really know much about him. Well, about my second or third meeting, this guy comes in. He's got this big book. It looks like it's been drugged behind a car. And it's held together with rubber bands. And, I mean, it's just the most god-awful. Still got it, you know. Now he's got it held together. I mean, it's when he reads how it works, it's like rarely have we seen a person fail who, I mean, it's unbelievable. And so anyway, that was John. And John became my sponsor. And John's sponsor was a man named Leon, who has 47, 48 years of sobriety. Leon has a book meeting Friday nights in Dexter, Missouri. Ever so often, at that big book meeting, you can hear the phrase, "This is what Bill Wilson told me he meant when he wrote this step." That's out of Leon's mouth. Now, I don't know about the big book studies you go to, whether you can hear those words or not. But if you go to Leon's big book study, you can hear it, because he heard what Bill Wilson said he meant when he wrote that step. Now, I don't know, you know. That sounds fairly authoritative to me. And when he tells me something, I listen to him. And that's kind of the AA that I got, was from John and Leon. And it was your basic, like Laura didn't talk about it last night. She didn't use what she usually refers to it as in Luther, Oklahoma, as dirt AA, which is your basic down-to-earth, unblemished, undiluted, you know, 12 steps, 12 traditions, 12 concepts AA. But that's what I got, and that's all I got to give away. And that's what I got from Leon and John. And I started working the steps, and because I didn't know there, I had a choice. You know, John and Leon didn't really tell me that I could come to AA and do anything else, you know. So I started working them immediately. And John, we used to call Dracula, because he lived with his mother, and she was up all day and slept at night. And he slept all day and was up all night. And so I started my fifth step about midnight. And I finished about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And because that was John's hours. And I can remember when I knew in my bones that this program would work. And it was at 5 o'clock in the morning when I finished my fifth step, and I walked in. And I turned my big book to page 75, and I read, "Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. And that's exactly how I felt. And I knew then that this program was meant for me and that it would work. And so I, at that point, I had no reservations and no feelings that I wasn't in the right place or this wouldn't work or anything like that. And I went ahead with the rest of the steps. And the, of course, the most difficult amends are to that first wife and to Amanda and Bill, my children, and trying to be a better father. And I think I've become one over the years. It's been very difficult in terms of you can't, no matter how you try, you can't make up for lost time and pain that's been given to children. It's difficult. One of the things that happened is my mother got involved in AA. She was one of these women. She went down to Memphis, and she used to go there and dry out. And the shrink would tell her, "Now, Rosemary, you can't drink." And she'd go home and not drink for a long time, and then she couldn't stand it anymore, and she'd start drinking. And then she'd go back, end up ultimately back down in Memphis and dry out. Well, anyway, I hit her. She actually had more sobriety than I did when I joined AA, and then she saw what fun and what joy I was having and what my friends were having in AA, and she joined. And she got a sponsor, and she started working the steps, and this was when she was, 70 years old, 65, 70 years old, and became an active member of AA and sponsored women, and she's dead now, but it was a delight. It was one of the gifts of this program to me. I got involved in service. The way I got in service was John told me, first Wednesday every month, we go to district meeting, pick me up at 6 o'clock. I said, okay. That's how I got involved in service. I showed up, first meeting, I walked in there as an observer. When I walked out, I was district CPC chairman. And at the end of the first couple of years or so, we had a guy in our group who we had picked out to be the district committee member, the DCM, and we'd all kind of had one of these pre-election deals that we decided that he'd probably make a good one. And on the way over to the district meeting, we said, "Now, Steve, you're going to be the DCM." He said, "Nope, not going to do it. I don't want to do that job. I'm not going to do it." So that kind of threw everything in a mess, and we were all sitting around trying to solve it. And somebody said, "Clayton, why don't you do it?" And I said, "Well, what do you have to have?" And I meant, how many years of sobriety? But Leon said, "A big ego, you'll do fine." And that's how I ended up being DCM for District 8 of the eastern area of Missouri. And then I started going to these area assemblies and in the eastern area, and they elected me alternate treasurer, and then they elected me treasurer, and then they elected me area chairman, and then they elected me as the area delegate to the 49th and 50th General Service Conferences in New York. And, I used to be pretty proud of that. What we did at the 49th and 50th General Service Conference was we kind of shepherded along the fourth edition of the Big Book, which I think is a great edition of the Big Book. And I used to think that was a real accomplishment until one night I heard John telling some newcomer that what he really needed to do was find acceptance in his life And he said, now, if you'll just turn here to page 449 of the big book. And he said, no, I forgot. It's not on there anymore. He said, we sent Clayton to New York, and he screwed up the big book. And now it's on, not on 449. And so I don't get to, I guess I didn't do such a hot job after all. My son Bill is, he goes to law school, and he doesn't know much about AA I don't think he's an alcoholic, but he hadn't really been fascinated by the recovery program of AA, but he is fascinated by AA as an organization and the way that we run things. And he can't understand how an organization of, you know, a couple million people of hugely diverse backgrounds, of all ages, of all cultures, of all political persuasions, can run itself when it has no dues or fees, it doesn't solicit or take money from anybody. If you hold a service position, you can't hold it for more than 2 years, and you can't ever hold it again, that all major decisions are reached by an agreement of two-thirds of the people making the decision, and that as soon as the voting is over, that the people that lost get to try to convince the people that won that they made a mistake. Now, he can't understand how you can run an organization like that and have any kind of success at all. And I just look at him, I said, it's just a miracle. You know, it's a God thing. And amen to that. Yeah, can I have an amen? And so that's been my service experience, and it's been really gratifying. One of the things that came out of my service experience was that during the time I was delegate, I was in St. Louis at the area assembly, and I met Laura, and we fell in love and sought no one's advice and got married in 4 months. You know, I would have, we didn't ask anybody, we didn't ask sponsors, we didn't ask sponsees, we just did it because we knew what the answer would be. That all those people would tell us to be cautious, and it was probably been good advice, but we were at the stage of our lives that we didn't think, we lived 150 miles away and didn't think that long distance relationships at our age would work, and we've been married 10 years and love each other very much. And they say God has a sense of humor. I never wanted to have children. I think God is a sadist. That's not quite true, but I'm on my second family, having never wanted children to start with. I have two stepchildren who I love very much, and in addition to the to my son, my daughter. My daughter started going to AA. She graduated from college and University of Denver with a business degree, and she became a ski bum. And she was in Colorado for a while, and then she went to Vermont. And when I visited her in the summer of 2003, she could not get me to the airport. Her boyfriend had to take me because she'd had a little bit too much to drink the night before. And she got in AA after that. And her sobriety date's October the 3rd, 2003. And then 5.5 months later, she killed herself. She was a victim of bipolar disease, which claims more than half of the people that have it. It's hideous. We knew this. I had spent a lot of time rescuing Amanda from various spots during her college years and after that, and so did her mother. And it was awful. It was hideous. The morning after Amanda died, the first person on my doorstep was Leon. Leon put his arms around me. My daughter was 29 years old, bipolar, and killed herself. Leon's daughter was 29 years old, bipolar, and killed herself. Leon put his arms around me and saved my life by what he told me. And the way he told me to act and the way he told me that we would get through it. And just as how he showed me to get through alcoholism and get through sobriety, he showed me how to get through this. And then in October, while we were at the Southwest Regional Forum, Jacob got shot. And the same people came to our rescue. And I saw a movie named with Mel Gibson in it. The movie is called When We Were Soldiers. And in the movie, Mel Gibson plays this commander of these soldiers in Vietnam, and they're a bunch of rangers that arrive by helicopter into this valley, and they get surrounded by all these Viet Cong, and they're attacking them, and they're about to be overrun and all of them killed. And Mel Gibson tells the radio man, he says, "Put out the words broken arrow." And apparently broken arrow meant that there was an American unit about to get overrun by the enemy, and that whatever American air forces heard that, they were all to come to where these troops were and drop all of the weapons, all of the bombs that they had in their planes to save the people who were about to get overrun. And that was my experience when Amanda died, and that was our experience when Jake got shot, that when we screamed broken arrow, everybody in AA came. And they came from St. Louis, and they came from Southeast Missouri, and we had people that extended their hands and their love and took Laura and I and just carried us through all those tragedies. And what I found out was that everything that they tell me about this program and have told me about this program, about when things happen to me and when things happen to us, that the people in this program will be there, and that no matter what happens in my life, that they'll carry me through, is true. And I'm up here to tell you that. That it's not. If you're new and you get in trouble and things happen to you, they'll be here. They'll stick with you. This is the family that I have, and this is the tribe I've chosen. And they're loyal as a bunch of dogs. That's all I have. Thank you very much.